My name is Rick Barraza. I'm the creative director at Synergy. Okay, thanks. The one, two fans in the audience. So the talk's Hollywood Draws First Blood. One of the great things about coming to a conference or being at a workshop is you really get to interact at times with some of your heroes, right, or your luminaries. So maybe it's hanging out with Bill Buxton at Mix, right, and you just got him and everything's great. Or O'Reilly, right, or Bruce Sterling at South by Southwest. For me, one of the favorite experiences I have with one of my big heroes is when Edward Tufte goes around and you go to one of his lectures. Can I see how many people have had the opportunity to go to one of Edward Tufte's conferences? Great. So if you don't know who he is, he's really the godfather of data visualizations. He literally wrote the books on this in the 20th century, and fantastic day-long sessions he still has. You get all his books and everything. One of my all-time heroes. So I was amazed when I was going through his books, and there's a whole section dedicated to magic. I don't know if you guys saw Sean's talk at a UX Lightning talk on magic, but when he read this, he says, in magical performances, knowledge about the revealed front view, what appears to be done, fails to yield reliable knowledge about the concealed back view, what is actually done. And it is the audience's misdirected assumption about such symmetric liability that makes the magic. Yes, Edward Tufte actually talks like this normal. He sounds like the architect from The Matrix when he talks, right? He's just this smart when he's talking. I can't, you're not getting that from me today. But that's what he actually sounds like. The main point that we're focusing on is the second paragraph, because that's what's germane to today's talk. He says, the techniques of conjuring are especially relevant to theories of information display. To create illusions is to engage in disinformation design, to corrupt the optical information, to deceive the audience. Thus, the strategies of magic suggest what not to do if our goal is truth-telling rather than illusion-making. And he goes on to explain this in his book. But it's a very interesting dichotomy that he sets up here between truth-telling and illusion-making. We think about this, and they seem, at the surface, at odds. Right? They want two very, very different things. And we see that the practitioners of both seem to come from two very different worlds, you know, Hollywood and Silicon Valley, right? And you can see this in the way they react to certain phrases. That should be neutral, right? The phrase smoke and mirrors. If you go to a developer and you say, that's smoke and mirrors, it's an insult, right? It's derogatory. You're saying something bad about what they've done. It's not smoke and mirrors, it's for real, blah, 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 right? And they're all getting like that, because I don't know, they go like that, a lot. And they're like, no, that's smoke and mirrors, right? But you go to Hollywood, it's like, that's smoke and mirrors. They're like, yeah, right? That's like $100 million opening weekend, right? And smoke and mirrors is something that you loftily aspire to in Hollywood, but it's something that's a bad phrase in our existing culture of development, right? You can also see in the way they handle their market, what they call their market. In Hollywood, their market, it's called the audience. It's movie-going magic, right? It's these people that are in there. It's the movie-going experience. What do we call our market? We call them users. And as Edward Tufte points out, there's only two industries that refer to their market as users, right? Us and drug pimps. And we're these two professions, and we like thinking about our market like this because we want to zombify them down to this mindless, speed, transaction-focused creature that just want to get in and out, must eat brains, must click, you know, and do your thing and get done. Right? And it's really interesting. It betrays this sensibility that culturally we've grown accustomed to with the history, the past couple decades of software development versus the centuries and millennia of lessons that the entertainment industry has taught us. And what's interesting is that this dichotomy does not exist, this binary choice does not exist in most mature industries. Most industries do not force you to make a binary pick between art and science. Most mature industries actually champion the spectrum between art and science. And yet for us, a lot of times, we seem to put up this wall between designers and developers. What's interesting is in most industries, they have a person right there in the middle who's called an architect, right? Every other industry. The problem, I believe, for software that we run into is that we allowed that label to be co-opted with none of the responsibilities that comes with that title in every other industry, right? Because we wanted architect, and we slapped it onto the biggest nerd in the room, right? The alpha nerd. Okay, here's all these programmers. You're the software architect, right? You're the alpha geek in this room. And they are doing architecture. They are doing logical structures, right? It is architecture to a way, but it's not architecture in the way most people understand it. It has nothing to do with human experiences. If you ask an architect what they do, they don't say, I make buildings. They say they create spaces for humans to interact with their environment and interact with each other. That's what an architect says they do. And yet, when we use the word architecture, as Bill Buxton brought out at MIX a couple years back, as we've been saying this for a while, what we really mean is structural engineer. Right? Our software architects are people who focus on making sure the thing doesn't blue screen. Logically, is the structure there? But their focus is not on what's the human experience. Right? But in most industries, this bridge is crossed by architects. And besides the talk on magic at the UX Lightning talk, I have a whole talk specifically on this rise of the hybrids that's on the third day. All the talks were great. August, Sean's, all of them are fantastic. But you can look at that up from the mixed talks if you want. That's not what we're talking about here. We're going to be looking at it from the other angle today on this merger between entertainment and information, because this is the way the industries are going. This is where our clients are starting to want this aspect. They're still business focused, but they want to make sure that these high brand exposed consumers are able to enjoy this. Our clients are wanting both. And so we as professionals are needing to span the spectrum between what traditionally we may have thought of as being very polarized design and entertainment and illusion making and story and what we think of as the sciences, development and information science, et cetera, right? We can no longer view them as silos. And what we're talking about together is actually experience architecture. This is how we've been qualifying the word architect now to differentiate from software architecture. It is experience architecture because it really is that point in the middle that balances out both form and function, viability, practicality, as well as seduction and motivation. But we're seeing this blurriness come in between Hollywood getting more high tech getting more Hollywood, and these emerging technologies and experiences are starting to create this magical world, and it's getting very, very powerful. It's this broad spectrum between the two industries now. But what's interesting is this is bringing up, and this is a manifestation of two phenomena I want to talk about, which is both a reaction and an instigator to everything we've been leading up to. These two phenomena, they play off each other. They did not start this past decade, but I do believe that they are going to be hitting their tipping point this next decade. The first phenomenon is the rise of the hybrid. These people who are becoming comfortable as a person representing that spectrum that comes in the middle. In software, a lot of us may already have that. How many people in our companies already have or are trying to fill the spot of an integrator, say, in the middle? Can I just see by a show of hands how many people are shifting that? Are the rest of you guys a designer and developer, lower the fence type stuff? Just curious. Okay. But I'm sure everybody has heard the phrase integrator, right? Maybe call it integrator, maybe call it experience architect. Just do not call it diviner, right? That's a ridiculous phrase. It does not show respect to the traditions of design and development. But this hybrid that's coming in the middle that's helping to work as the glue. But the more important phenomenon we'll be talking about today is the obsoleting of science fiction. And we're going to see how this interacts with everything we do as software developers and as technologists and what the challenges are coming up here. Because there are definitely two challenges as these empires of myth-making and truth-telling are starting to clash into each other violently. It is getting harder and harder to produce science fiction. If we look at the main voices of science fiction, we'll see these quotes that pop up, and they're saying it's getting hard to do my job, right? William Gibson doesn't write science fiction anymore. He writes emerging technology fiction. When you ask him, he doesn't qualify himself that way anymore. He used to. When he coined the phrase cyberspace in the early 80s, that was science fiction. That was Blade Runner, Dark City, science fiction. And now, the technologies he already has on the table are weird enough for him to craft a story. But this quote was a very Web 1.0 quote. If you were living in the Bay Area during the first Web 1.0 explosion in the mid-90s to early 2000s, this was the mantra of every person, right? And Tim O'Reilly beat this to death. It was just again and again and again. And he's kind of leveraged it as even the mantra of beginning Web 2.0 in the early 2000s. The future's already here. It's just not equally distributed. And that was like lightning strike, because then we have the ability of having premium experiences and have companies leapfrog into new markets, right? It was radically disruptive. But what we want to focus on isn't the technology application of this, because something weird started happening. We heard this phrase, and everybody rushed to the technology. Give them pieces of technology that get them to the future faster. But why this was powerful is when you think about this from a design implication. In the keynote this morning, they put it great when they're saying it's not so much what the technology does, but what it reflects back to you as the person using it. I remember standing in line the day the iPhone 1 came out with other people, right, and seeing how crazy it was. And some people were there for days, right, an iPhone 1, iPhone 2, this release. And I remember being there, and I fortunately only had to stand in line for like an hour, right, because I live in San Diego, but in like a really suburbs, boonies side of San Diego, right? So I was able to jump right in line. But some people were there like all day, took off work, they wanted to get that. The security guards are saying, be careful, because you're gonna get jumped if you pull this out at the clubs, right? I mean, it was ridiculous what was going on, right? It was like the Shroud of Turin. You're like buying it in like this little box for yourself. But what's funny is what would happen when you'd get that iPhone? You take it out, and for the next 2 months, you lived in this bubble of the future that you got to live in first before anybody else. And how did it reflect back on you in terms of your values and your coolness? And this is the design implication of what this is actually talking about. It's not so much the technology. This started happening around the middle of the last decade. The shift into experience and branding and technology fusing in with your personal brand and allowing you to have that value of living in a bubble of the future. And it actually had nothing to do with the technology at a certain point. It had to do with what the technology represented. So if we're a designer for a hybrid, right, we're magicians, we like to see how things work, but most people, they want, this is what's driving them toward emerging technologies, because now emerging technologies are allowing people to wrap themselves up in that. But again, this is very the predictable web. Some of us might still be working on it here, some of us already moved beyond this kind of web 2.0, and we're already working day jobs in web 3.0, and this big shift happened a couple years back. And things started getting weird besides unpredictable. And so this next quote, the guy there is Alan Kay. He's not a writer. He's actually one of the godfathers of artificial intelligence. In the movie Tron, the guy Alan in the movie, he's actually named after this guy, Alan Kay. The script was written on one of his like very first personal machines. I mean, Alan Kay is just like a very, he's like a godfather to nerds, right? He's just like one of the big guys. But he was asked one time, what's technology? And he said this great quote. He said, technology is anything invented after you were born. And what's funny about that is it's true. I was born in the early 70s. My parents were older when they had me. They remember a world with no TV. Then they remember black and white TV coming in, and it was disruptive technology. It changed everything they knew. And then they saw color TV come in, and it was bleeding edge, and now it's in color, right in your living room. It was a brave new world for them. But when I was born, shortly after color TV, it wasn't technology for me. It was my babysitter, right? It was the fourth member of my family, right? It's my little brother, right? It's TV. I see my five-year-old today, and we've had these conversations with Razorfish and other people here. I work from home, and I do work in emerging technologies and R&D, and so my daughter has grown up with all of these super advanced technologies around her before she's even entered school, right? And so for her, multi-touch isn't technology, right? Like many of us here, she'll go up to a screen and she'll touch it, and if the screen doesn't respond, the screen is broken, right? There's something wrong with the screen because it's not letting me do anything, right? That's her thinking in there. And it's really interesting. What's more interesting, though, is I have a one-year-old, and he's coming to consciousness now in a world where he walks into the living room or sees me walk into the living room, and I wave to my big TV, say, Xbox Connect, and then I start playing around, doing really bad dancing. I won't try and duplicate here on stage, right? But he sees this. He sees me talking to the machine and doing gestures to the machine and immersing myself in this virtual reality. So even the generation gap between my five-year-old, to whom multi-touch is, and my son, to whom soft AI vision algorithms 30 frames a second, this is not technology. And for us, it's the fulfillment of this dream we've had all our lives. And they're being born right now where it is as common as the wallpaper. This is not technology to them, it's their environment. What challenges are we gonna have in 10 years when these guys enter the market? And we're gonna try to have to impress them or seduce them as designers, and hopefully we're still working in 10 years, right? And they're the people you're targeting. How much of an up-ramp are you gonna have to do to target people to who, for us, the bleeding edge right now is literally as common as a painting on the wall, right? So things have started getting very weird very fast. In fact, it's gotten to this point. Does anybody recognize the last person on the slide? There's Warren Ellis, he's like a big futurist. There's the Alan Moore, Warren Ellis, Grant Morrison. These are these big British luminaries, right? They write comics and movies and scripts and write for Wired and Futurist. But he has a great quote, right? So if we put this in years, William Gibson's very 2001, that quote, We saw things started getting weird with the iPhone in 2007, 2008, Surface 1 started coming in, Alan Kay's quote. The quote that drives me every day now at work is actually this one from Warren Ellis. The future isn't dead. We simply overtook it and then shot off into a new territory that we don't have the maps for yet. And this is where we're hitting right now in a post-Web 2.0 world. Things have gotten really weird and are continuing to get weirder and weirder, faster and faster, and the maps we've had aren't up to date anymore. We're going to see some of the reasons why that's not up to date. But what is for sure is these things are changing because these massive forces are colliding together and accelerating and pushing things through, and everybody's asking, where is this heading, right? Where is this heading? Where is this heading? This is the big question. And where is this heading? Well, maybe, right? The singularity, that's where some people believe. Some people believe, you know, in the Ray Kurzweil, he's going to live to infinity, and he's getting all his pills, right? Because it's just a couple more decades, and he'll be able to dump himself into a machine, and he'll have immortality, right? The rapture of the nerds, that they called it, right? The rapture for the secular nerds out there, right? Now, some people have this as the lofty ideal. They hope this is the case. They hope they're leading to a singularity point, right? And it's called a singularity because we don't know what happens afterward. Because we stop being human and we start becoming post-human. This may or may not be true. It's almost a religious belief at this time, if you want. That's on one end. On the other end of the spectrum is like Armageddon, right? And like Grey Goo and all this stuff here. So somewhere between this broad spectrum of total annihilation and complete merger with machines, right, it is anybody's guess. But one thing for sure that is going on is we have started the acceleration. We don't know if we're getting to go from human to post-human. But for sure, we are in the middle area where we're starting to see human to transhuman. We are moving towards something, and we're getting there faster and faster, and science fact is obsoleting science fiction faster and faster, and it's starting to catch up. So we can consider this the acceleration, this Moore's law fueled exponential curve that for the past couple decades, it's been relatively flat, but we have started to hit the elbow, and we're starting to shoot up at an area exponentially. And as humans, we're not used to exponential growth. It's not in our natural frame of things to think about it. The only time you really experience exponential growth is when you make a baby and then the baby comes out, right? But even that's hidden from us, right? It starts with two cells getting together, and then 9 months later, well, I won't go into birds and the bees, right? Hopefully everybody here understands, but that's really the only time that we experience exponential growth, and we don't even get to see it, right? We don't understand exponential growth, so the implications not only of Moore's Law and technology, but Moore's Law and the expectations of our audiences as designers and technologists, that's where the things are going to be getting really, really weird. They started around 4 years ago, and we're starting to pick up steam now, and the next 10 years will be crazy. In fact, part of the slide is to challenge how much of this is real and how much of this is science fiction. Now, I consume mass quantities of pop culture, you know, unfortunately, to the chagrin of my parents, but now it's part of my job, so I get paid for it, so that's okay. But, you know, so I know this. I also put the slides together, but it's really hard to tell. And so it's interesting. I mean, obviously, Iron Man is science fiction, because we all know Tony Stark. We all know Robert Downey Jr., so we'll take him out of it, right? But technology is starting to outpace science fiction. People are making predictions, and before that book gets to print, a new technology has obsoleted their prediction vector. Let's take all the rest that is fiction off this slide. Everything that's left is real. And this is real from a couple years back. We are the practitioners. We're finally starting to catch up in what we're actually doing. You know, we worked on the emotive headset, which you'll see about. The AR, the Parrot AR drone. Has anybody bought one or had a chance to play with one or seen this drone up here? It's great. It just came out from France last year. You turn it on. It hovers, you push the button, and your six-axis control on your phone controls the guy. You TV it on. It's complete stabilization. It has soft AI controlling the terrain. It has a camera that's streaming Wi-Fi to your phone. So literally, you have a flying drone like military Terminator, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, right? And it's $299 at Brookstone. First-generation consumer-facing technology. It is amazing. I had my friend over for dinner, their family, and he got a chance to play with it. And he's like, I feel like I'm in Back to the Future. It's one of those chill experiences that you play for first generation technologies. And we'll be talking about some other projects, right? But the big point here is as designers, as things are changing, what's really our role? Because it's not so much about seduction and experience anymore. Our role as designers is shifting to become the translators, the facilitators, the midwives, to help these changes that are unstoppably coming faster and faster between the technology priesthood, right, the technology wizards, and the muggles who buy the stuff at a certain point. And the only people standing there in the middle are us doing our job to make it accessible. But the inverse is also true. It's not just that science, that technology is catching up and outpacing science fiction. The inverse is true now as well, and we have to take that account. It's actually more true and more important for us. Just because the technology is new does not mean they haven't seen it before. Or worse, have assumptions, conditioned expectations about how it's supposed to behave, even if it's wrong. This is one of the only times in software when you're focusing on emerging technologies that we get to ask ourselves what graphic designers should never ask themselves. And that's, when is it okay to lie to my user? Now, as graphic designer, no, I don't do that, right? It's idealized and holy, and you have to always focus on the truth and foster that. That's not true for emerging technology. When you're dealing with transitional technologies, when you take out a phone and you take a picture on iPhone 1.0 and iPhones to date, right? What sound do you hear? You hear a shudder, right? You're actually stupider for having heard that sound, because there's nothing in this phone that's a shudder mechanism. Why in the world are you doing an anachronistic sound? Because for large populations who live in an analog world and are transitioning to a digital world, you do need to have these experiences architected and crafted into it so that it is accessible to them as they're shifting between radically disruptive paradigms. Right? And that's where emerging technology design is all about. So against the magician's code, I'm going to walk through a couple projects that I've done over the years that basically, and I'll explain some of the thinking that went in behind them as to why they got popular at that point, right? So 2008 was a biggie, 2007 actually was the year. 2007 was a big year for announcements. 2008 was when things started getting released. But the iPhone 1, people started seeing that, and people started seeing the Surface 1.0. Right? And all of a sudden, everybody's like, Minority Report, because that was the last big, you know, Minority Report. Minority Report came out in 2002, and people loved it. Everybody loved it, fell in love with it. If you touched this at all, any type of design or technology, you loved the interfaces at the movie. It was the birth of NUI at this tipping point. It was this tipping point of consciousness. But then in 2006, the Wii came out, and then all of a sudden, people were having this new experience that hadn't happened before. Right, Brian Peek created a managed DLL for it, and shortly thereafter, Johnny Cheng Li, while still in Cornell, before going to Microsoft, created a Wiimote hack, because the camera, the wand, actually has a camera on the front, not the lights. Right, the camera looks at the bar on the Wii for the first generation, and so he simply had the stroke that I thought was genius. He simply turned the camera around, and then started having reflective tape, so that the camera could see where his hands were, and he's able to get multi-tracking now on the machines. It was really, really good. I saw that, and again, standing on the shoulders of giants, because that's what I do. I'm a decent developer. I'm not an amazing developer. I work with amazing developers, but I get that, and I go, that's really, really cool, but I can make it more accessible, right? We can wrap this in a better story. So we came out with Project Maestro. And this birthed Synergy Labs, birthed the R&D, go to South by Southwest, got a lot of press and everything like that. But here's this evolution of thinking, and you'll notice that I have little blue finger lights on my fingers. And this is infrared technology. I'll just let that sink in for a little bit, right? Here's the visible spectrum. You got the reds and infrareds over here. Right, you got the blues over here. There's no need for those blue lights, but certain people needed to see it, because Tom Cruise has those stupid little blue lights on his fingertips and two fingers missing on his gloves, so we need to have two fingers missing on our gloves and the blue little lights, and as soon as they see it, they can say, oh my God, it's Minority Report! And CNN will write about it, and you'll go to South by Southwest on Microsoft's time, and you'll present it, and newscasters from Univision will come in and hablar contigo en español, because they really want to hear what's going on, because you have the little blue lights on your fingers, right? It's an accessible way of getting them into these experienced sketches of technology. A couple years later, the Emotive headset came out. There was Emotive and Neurosky. And on this one, what's interesting on this one, is basically you stick it on and you think command to the software. It's an amazing piece of technology. I think it's a little overpriced, and the APIs locked out once it finally hit the market, but this was before it came out. And that was off the record, right? It's not getting recorded or anything like that. Okay. What's interesting, though, with the emotive headset is that it's thought control. We've had almost a third of a century of pop culture pushing in thought control to us, right? Even from Star Wars, The Force, but you think Firefox. Most importantly, you see like X-Men, Akira, even The Matrix, Dark City. We see Force Unleashed, right? We see this paradigm that Hollywood has taught, that this is what mind power looks like. These are the visual cues of mind power, right? And yet when the Emotive Company came out and they did their first alpha release on YouTube, it had 20,000 hits, right? Which is not a lot for something that's a radically disruptive technology. And I remember being at work and all my nerd friends, right? And I'm half nerd myself, so I can, you know, my nerd friends are like, wow, that was like really, really cool. And I'm excited about it, changing my world. I want to play with this technology. I go home and I show my wife, and she's like, yeah, so what? Right? Because it's too much of a jump. She's not a technologist, right? But it's too much of a jump for where she's coming from. So I called them up and I said, Rick Braza, Principal Experience Architect at Synergy. I'd love if you can kind of disappear one of your headsets and I'll play around and see what we can do with it, right? So I created this experience and it was really in WPF. And so, this was maybe, the Project Maestro, by the way, was 10 days. And this was around 36 hours, right? But it comes in using design and development, fusing Never, wrapping it up in a story, getting seduction right. Again, this isn't a finished product. These are experience sketches to help technology, new technology, start reaching out beyond that kind of inner sanctum of just technologists, making it more accessible to people. And what's I learned something with this. I did this transaction. I made it really pretty, or I thought it was pretty, and had the slides come in, and I'd push, and then the menus would come in, and I'd think left, I'd think right, and it'd rotate. And I'd bring my friend, my next-door neighbor over, who's not into technology, and, hey, check it out, right? Put on the headset, think, right? Boop, you know, like a picture would change. He's like, yeah, fake. I Photoshop, right? Like, totally fake, like I pre-timed it or something like that, right? And I looked at the guy, and you really have to realize that as a non-technologist, they are conditioned by Hollywood. Hollywood has drawn first blood in his mind. And so what I needed to do is I needed to add a pixel shader, a ripple effect. Because if there's one thing Hollywood has taught us, is if you're using your mind to do anything, it warps the very fabric of space-time around you in this ripple of reality. So I had to drop in a pixel shader effect in WPF, and then so I had there, it came in, and I had to put it on, looking at the screen, and the picture goes, oh my God, you just used your mind to interface with the computer, right? And it was like this jaw drop. And it's funny, and as magicians were laughing, right? Because you usually do the trick well before they actually see the trick. I mean, that's the whole point. And as developers, a pure developer, you're looking at this, and the hardest part, the mind-bogglingest part is firing up the event. Right? You have this thing, it's reading your brain to fire the right event on your client to then start the UI. That's the magic for us, right? That's the real, that's the trick. And yet as soon as the event is fired, they just drop it. There's no architecture of experience. And since it is a magic trick, right, you do need to architect that experience because you need to start realizing that just because the technology is new doesn't mean they haven't seen it before, doesn't mean they grew up with it. And they may have preconceived assumptions about how it works. And for first generational technologies, you have to take that into account. The last example is a lot of Surface 2 is coming out now, multi-touch is continuing to get big, but it's sensitive to me and with everybody. I was Flash years and years before I took Silverlight into my toolbox as well and then continued in the Microsoft stack, but most of us who are interaction designers or hybrids or experience architects, a lot of us started with Flash, because Flash was this radically disruptive tool that came out and said, here, be smart and creative at the same time. And nothing before that had that popularity to give us that power to be the person who did it both. I'm going to code on the timeline, right? It's just where developers would look at it and say, you know, you can't code on the timeline, that's bad, right? And designers would look at it and say, you know, why would I want to go to and play, right? But for some of us, we're right there in the middle, and we thought it was magical. I can draw and then code at the same time, and I can start creating these things. And it burst out this whole rich phenomenon, this whole Web 1.0 came because of that, because it offered rich and reach at the same time. It was radically disruptive in the late 90s. And we had pioneers, right? We had Hillman Curtis, we had Joshua Davis, he's all tatted up, you know, he's a designer, and he writes a development book. When did that ever happen? When would a designer write one of the most popular selling developer books, and he wrote Flash to the Core? It was really crazy, but the metaphors that came in were all drag, slide, and fade. That's what 10 years ago, that was the metaphor interactions. And if you could master drag, slide, and fade, you had a really, really good job. Because that's what people started to expect. That's what they were conditioned for. But as NUI started coming in and science fiction Basically, Drag Slide and Fade provided rich screens, and we caught up to all the fake screens that Hollywood had been showing us. Right? We started creating these rich experiences. So Hollywood needs to leapfrog again. We got to do something different that's not being done. So they start coming in a lot heavier on these newbie experiences. The island comes in with Object UI. There's that great architectural table. Multi-touch comes in. Group UI, Quantum of Solace, right? CSI, Zoom In, Enhance, you know, all types of stuff. All of a sudden, Hollywood starts pushing this gauntlet, this next gauntlet of newbie. And newbie starts catching up right along with it. Well, at the same time, we have industrial calculus coming in. We saw the Boyds and the Birdhouse and the Olympics come in. And then something really interesting happens in 2005. At the E3 Expo, and I'm a firm believer that games are always at the forefront. Usually it goes games, then it goes agency, and then it goes into work. And usually where games go, everything else eventually follows. But games really have that ultimate pressing need of experience to the level of suspending belief, right? And so these pioneers, how do you start differentiating games when all games are HDR and super glossy and 60 frames a second? How do you differentiate on design when what most people consider design becomes ubiquitous? Even on the web, we started running into that problem. When everything has rounded corners and drop shadows and gradients and glossy, how do you start differentiating? When that's just your buy-in. Now, games usually are ahead of us by a couple of years. And in E3, the big slogan was, physics is the new graphics. All of a sudden, the physics needs to be more real. If everything starts looking hyper-real, things need to be moving hyper-real. And we started seeing this change into things like the popularity of Little Big Planet and on and on. And so when Surface 1 came out, we needed to have that in. If we lost the mouse as proxy, when I'm getting something and I'm flicking it, it better be smooth. It better be as smooth as I'm expecting, because you're asking me to believe a metaphor that I'm physically manipulating objects. So if that object is clunky in any way, I can no longer suspend belief. As soon as your physics is clunky, it's bad. And we know this now, again, to pause the tape, right? Google physics sucks, right? On the Android, it's good enough physics. And a lot of Microsoft products early on had that challenge as well. iPhone really nailed it from the very first generation. But what did everybody do when the new Windows Phone 7s came out? We wanted to see how responsive it was, and that phone was nice. You flick it, and it looks good, and every one of us said, oh, thank goodness, right? They got it. That was really the thing. As beautiful as Metro is, it's that physics in it that really happened. Surface 2 and in 2011 now, we have a challenge, right? Surface 1 came out in a pre-iPhone world. Surface 2 is coming out in a post-Kinect world. In 2007, we might forget how new multi-touch is, right? How new smartphones are. I have a theory that it's because we're all suffering from a constant state of future shock. And this is only going to get worse before it gets better. My wife, I've been married, we're coming on 10 years, but sometimes we get into this place where you kind of rewrite the history. Right, so it's like, hey, remember when you went to that place, da-da-da? Oh, it wasn't you. Right, and like you have to sleep on the couch for like a couple of nights. It's like, aha, you know, don't ever, you know. But we kind of have that point. We rewrite history with people that we care about. We start rewriting history with technology that we care about. And a lot of times we think, oh, yeah, well, we've just always had multi-touch. We're in this like state of denial. It's just always been this way. But it wasn't. In 2007, only nerds had smartphones. I don't even know what they were called, right? Like PDAs, assistants, right? These types of things. Right? In the span of 12 months, soccer moms had multi-touch in their purse, right? In the span of 12 months. It was less than 18 months ago that people were making fun of the name iPad. Hope you can remember that. Right? Less than 18 months ago, they were making fun of the name, you know, immature things, of course, right? But everybody was laughing at it. It was less than 18 months ago. And now how are people right now? It's hard for us to remember a world when we don't have tablets, when we don't have smartphones. So these things are happening faster and faster. And so today, there's kind of this new change of challenges, because that was just Web 2.0. Now we're getting to Web 3.0, where we're moving into a post-PC world. And let's talk really quick about what just happened, because it's really important for us as designers. A couple weeks back, Windows 8 was announced, All Things D, they showed it. The same week, macOS 10 showed Lion, right? And Google's kind of just there for the ride, right? They're just tracking your search history. They're really not good about design Google Circles a little bit, but you know, they've always been the swap meet. They're making a lot of money. They're Walmart making a lot of money. Good enough experiences. Apple's kind of Louis Vuitton, and Microsoft's in the middle, really trying to swim upstream. That's in reality. That's where things are. With Metro and a lot of these styles, they've really jumped massively into what anybody's expecting. And now the game's on. Right now, there's a good fight going on right now. But Google's definitely not the person fighting on the UX. It is getting to this heads up with Microsoft and Lion. That's not what we're talking about. What we want to think about is look at the interfaces. Well, you can't see the lion, but what's next after lion? You can't go anywhere after lion. Lion's king of the jungle, right? So you have all these big cats, big desktop visuals, and you're finally getting in lion, and lion's big, but what's going to come after that, right? Is there a little writing on the wall here of what's going on? More importantly, look at Windows 8. What happened for the very first time, is desktop experiences finally were being influenced by mobile phone experiences. Let's not lose sight of what that means, because this entire river of the future of software has been churning and churning and churning around the desktop. And what just happened a couple weeks ago is the three biggest silos stopped, and the entire river has started going uphill. To have Windows 8 look like Windows Phone 7, when you install Lion, and all of a sudden, instead of swiping down on your touchpad to scroll down like you're used to, you actually have to flick up just to visualize it, right? If I have my PowerBook, and I'm going down on my touchpad to go down the window, that got inverted now. I have to go up, because that's the behavior I have on my iPhone when I want to go up. This directional change happened, and the OS is now bringing in gestures as well as behaviors that are in the iPhone, that are in the iOS experience, right? This is a very, very big change, and it's one of the reasons why things are getting weird. So we have to remember magic is technique and presentation. So the areas I would encourage you guys to look at today to stay relevant, to get into this race, because it is a great, great time to be doing what we're doing right now. But 5 points you really want to not lose sight of is physics is the new graphics, which we talked about. But real-time vision algorithms are changing everything very, very quickly. At $150 price point for a consumer first-generation Kinect, it's insane. Three, always on, always connected. Again, my five-year-old, we got on a plane, we were flying up to Seattle. She took out her iPad halfway up, and she looks at me and she has this look of confusion, and she goes, "Dad, Netflix doesn't work." And I had to say, "Well, there's no internet here." And it popped her brain, because she couldn't conceive in like her little five-year-old brain this concept of being disconnected from the internet, right? And it was really funny watching this expression on her face, because she's like, "What else isn't dependable? Could there be no air? Could there be like no gravity?" Like, she just hadn't entered her consciousness, because for her, it's not technology, it's her environment, and it's always on and it's always connected. Right? Location and proximity, bumping things, as well as rich and reach being coupled. Massive props to IE9, going down to the GPU with Canvas, being able to bring rich and reach. I had the privilege of seeing it out on the Mango release, or Mongo release if you're Hispanic. And just amazing, amazingly fast. We're getting to that point, HTML5, a lot of these technologies giving us rich and reach. But as we get into this, and I'm going to have to start flying through time, taking a little bit of time. There are a couple metaphors, because if you haven't done this before, you might say, well Rick, how do you do it? What are some practical tips? We've done a lot of big level talking. Give us some practical tips as we're doing things, or what are some tools you use? Since we are talking about translation, and we are talking about people learning something that could be disruptively new to their assumptions, metaphors are that very, very powerful tool that we have. I put Kirby Crackle up here because when I was talking to Bruce Sterling, who's one of my favorite science fiction authors, we were at Austin, I was explaining what I do with technology, and we were having this really cool geeky talk, and then he's like, "Oh, it's the Kirby Crackle." Being a closet comic book nerd, right, which not now, thanks internet, right, but now everybody knows, but I love comics, I still do, right? And so I knew instantly what he was talking about, but Kirby was the artist in the 60s, really pioneered a lot of the stuff, but when he needed to do magicians, right? Doctor Strange. Now, Doctor Strange did the pose, but it's magic, and magic is invisible. Right? So we needed to do that like little crackle around the hand so that you knew that it was like the jazz fingers, right, of graphic design. And so a lot of times this is what we're talking about. It's this Kirby crackle, it's this visual manifestation, so people understand, okay, what's really going on might be invisible to me, But I know that these are signposts. It's the Vaseline on the lens, right, that they do in the 60s. When they have Vaseline on the lens, you know you're entering a dream sequence. Right? It's going, you can't see the edge. Okay, this is dream sequence, right? These are the metaphors we're talking about. So there are three schools of metaphors we're going to go through very, very quickly. These overlap, and they're not exclusive to each other. Think of these as very large silos. The first one is the most obvious one, and people who do not consume mass quantities of pop culture are in this industry. When you think of the factory environment, it's really what we would consider classical science fiction, right? It's the promise of the industrial age down to the individual person. It's about time optimization, work, microwaves, Roombas, robots, computer terminals that you ask something, you get information back, even coding for fun, right? I mean, this is just classical factory model. But some of the more interesting ones that are emerging are this public utility metaphor. This is relatively new. And we're starting to see it a lot. You see it in Microsoft 2019 videos, right? You're starting to see it more in Minority Report with the advertising. This is the concept that it's not just your personal factories and your home living spaces, but wherever you go, wherever there's electricity, there's access to information in a public-facing environment. This is relatively new, and it defines a metaphor that we can start leveraging when we want to craft our experiences with our technology. A minor metaphor, but one that's very powerful when done right, is the nature metaphor. Using technology and pushing it through to get us back to a pre-industrialized age. It's the technologies in the movie The Fountain, right? Or you see the biomimetic robots, that are popping up. You see those videos and it's just cool, right? They move like nature. A lot of times in Hollywood, they use more nature technologies when they want to invoke an advanced alien technology. Be it John Carter from Mars coming out next year, be it Avatar and you're jacking into a tree, right, as opposed to jacking into the Matrix, right? But this nature metaphor is something that taps into an inner longing of people who really are trying to both embrace technology and get away from technology. But the next one's very, very tricky. This is the vapor. As we're moving to this area where things are getting smaller and smaller in nanotechnology, it's really hard for Hollywood to visualize this. We'll talk about this a little bit more. Virtual reality, yeah, that is a monkey with a VR goggle. No, I don't mean Keanu Reeves. I mean down here on a. But virtual reality is really interesting because we mentioned it as being often called the rapture of the nerds. But what's interesting here is that virtual reality had its peak, and you don't hear that much about it. Virtual reality rose in the 90s because a lot of us in this kind of nerd-driven technology, we all wanted to get away, right? We didn't have proms and we were reading our math books and so we're going to make VR and we'll come in and we'll be gods, right? And it comes out and so you get all this stuff in Matrix and all this types of stuff. And the market says, no, I actually kind of like my life the way it is. What I'd like, though, instead of getting lost in the internet, I'd love the internet to come out into my world, right? And I actually would want augmented reality to come into my world. A lot of times we might miss the subtle shift, but it is a fundamental change in direction from somebody escaping into a virtual world to somebody having their grounded real world augmented with parallel dimensions of data. And if we don't understand the differences, it's really hard for us to craft the right experience with the right look. And also the panopticon is an environment where basically everything's tracked, everything monitored, and everybody has, or at least powerful entities have access to that data, right? But these are environmental metaphors that you can pick from as you're basically trying to set up the scene of what this experience architecture, of what this experience sketch is going to do in 2011, if this, you're lucky enough to have this as your job or your hobby. There's also interaction metaphors. There's the most obvious one, the terminal metaphor. How are people going to interact with this tool that you want to talk about, this emerging technology? There's a terminal mindset where it is very transactional. I'm going to walk up, I'm going to touch, I'm going to request, I'm going to flick, and I'm going to get a response. Just like in the factory model of environment, the terminal model of interaction is the most common one. But if you really want to make a name for yourself and get attention, you might want to start picking from the lesser known interaction metaphors. There's the auto-magic way of presenting your technology, right? This thing where the technology is invisible and hidden, such as cars. You get into a car, doesn't matter what car you get into, you know that you're going to, have signals, or you know you're having wipers, you know you're going to do direction, but everything's totally different. The technology is hidden from you. Or the other way, it automatically happens. These are plants that are twittering out that they're low on water to your account, right? Because you're using Netduino and sensors. No human interaction, but still immersion. There's an interesting metaphor out there, and one that I've been charmed with since a year or so ago. Donald Norman wrote the book, The Design of Future Things, and he had this great point on it, on animism. On interacting with technology, as an animal. And it's interesting now because as we're getting from soft AI to hard AI, sometimes we imbue too much smoke and mirrors. You get into a car and your car speaks to you, maybe in a British accent, you know, good morning, whatever, you know, and you're driving, you put automatic pilot, and you start assuming, you start imbuing the technology with too much intelligence because it has just enough intelligence to fake you out. Right? But suddenly, all of a sudden, you set up your cruise control, and then you're getting too close to a car, and so it drops down your cruise control automatically for you, and then your off ramp comes in, you get off, and then your car lurches forward, right? Because it's smart enough to know to slow you down, but it's not smart enough to realize you're getting off the off ramp, right? So we start getting into this really uncanny valley of AI right now, and Donald Norman suggests, instead of, as an example of cars, instead of it trying to be human, why don't we think of it as a horse? Why don't we interact with it? Because if you're a horse and a rider, all of a sudden, you respect the horse as being intelligent, but it's not the same type of human intelligence. So when it starts doing its gestures and its reactions and you do your reactions, sometimes this gets you out of a very strong pickle if you convert it into animism instead of trying to fake AI. Prosthetic cybernetic interaction experiences, which are extensions of your nervous system, and then magic objects, right? Finally, scale metaphors, and we're flying through these. We got to remember, most of us focus on the torso level, kind of this desktop level. That's kind of the bell curve. But if you really want to draw attention to the technologies, and again, using the right metaphors for the technologies, going down from torso to arm, tablet is relatively new, down to hand, things that you hold, put in your pocket, down to skin, right? Your sensors, your Fitbits and stuff. Going up the other way, it started expanding out from your dedicated sit-down torso to your body, and to your public area. But these metaphors, sometimes it's great if you're kind of, if you do get R&D budget and you're trying to brainstorm and figure stuff out, kind of see what you want to play with, it's fun to just kind of match these up. Can I do a body level scale metaphor that uses animism interactions in a panopticon environment? Right, so it's a good way to brainstorm of doing problem solving this way, and I can give this slide to you guys. The very last slide, because we're running short on time, the upper limits of Hollywood. There is one warning to everything we've said, and that comes to do with the very real change that's happening in real technology versus Hollywood technology, because Hollywood is limited by the fact that it's based on projection technologies. It starts 1977, people are doing interactive holograms on Star Wars, right? There's Chewbacca and there's C-3PO. And then they keep throwing down different gauntlets, right? It's Blade Runner and you're zooming in on pictures and we nail that, right? It's Blade Runner and big screen displays and that looks like Times Square now today, right? It's HUDs in Terminator and we get there and in RoboCop. It's multi-touch and the L-car system on Star Trek Next Generation and we nail that too, right? We're starting to get into goggles and we have Game Boy Power Glove, right? And they keep throwing gauntlets and people keep catching up, and then we get to Minority Report, and nobody's gonna get that, and then Kinect comes, and now everybody has it in their living room. So the last gauntlet that Hollywood is throwing down is they are actually going full circle to interactive holograms again. Now you see Tony Stark walking up, and it's an interactive hologram. You see Avatar, and it's an interactive hologram. Because they're limited to this point, they're brushing up against this wall, because in reality, we are shifting from projection technologies to perception technologies. And it's getting really hard to tell a story of what the world looks like through the air or on your phone when it looks different for every single person that's holding up a phone. And this is where real technology is heading right now, and it's getting there quickly with Pico projectors, it's getting there quickly with VR glasses coming out soon, much later than that, LED contacts. But this big shift from projection technologies to perception technologies, Hollywood can't get there yet, and it's terrifying to them. So we continue to see them looping back to 1977 interactive holograms. Finally, putting software in its place. Second to last slide, Sean. This is how we often think about the future, and we think about all this, we've had the roller coaster hour, hopefully you've enjoyed it. We've just kind of gone through up and down the stack of information technology, future, pop culture. This is often how we think of the world, though. So information technology, here's everything else. When you talk to futurists and you talk to people whose job it is focusing on this, though, this is how they see the world. It's called the GRIN stack. Genetics, robotics, IT, and nanotech. And what's interesting is the very same changes that we're experiencing right now in IT that are blowing our minds and are making us obsolete faster and faster are happening in genetics, and they're happening in robotics, and they're happening in nanotech. And this GRIN stack, all components are growing exponentially, and we're getting to the area that they're starting to overlap, and they're starting to merge together, and they're starting to clash, and things are getting really, really weird, really, really fast. And that's the next 10 years from where we are right now. We've already seen the beginnings of this And this is more and more of what we're going to have to look forward to. So if you are a designer and you do focus on translating new technologies, you do have job security for at least the next 10 years still. The robots come and take over the world. Thank you.